Carolyn Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, we're wishing you the best. We really enjoy getting your comments and questions, and you can find us at naturalnurse.com. You can even call us at 800-829-0918. We have lots of classes available, and you can become certified in some aspect of natural medicine, depending on what your interest is. And for those of you who are already licensed, such as nurses, midwives, registered dietitians, massage therapists, acupuncturists, we have CE Broker certified education courses, and you can take your credits that you might need for re-licensing requirements. And those of you who are not licensed can get a certification from our education. So we're so happy to have you with us, and we love to see you in person. We have lots of in-person classes coming up, such as herbal identification and medicine making, where we go out in the field and gather wild plants that grow wherever you are. All of them can be used for food and medicine. You have to know which ones, of course, so you don't get the poisonous lookalikes. And we have a day in Chinatown where we interact with traditional medical healers. That means traditional Chinese medicine. And we have that coming up in the fall. This year it will be September 24th, that's 2017, for those of you who might be listening to this later, but we do have it yearly. And we also have our yearly trip to Jamaica. That's Jamaica, West Indies, not Jamaica, New York, where we live with indigenous culture people. It's our 30th year of doing this trip. And that trip actually has college credits through the University of Bridgeport. So you're welcome to join us for any of these events. We have free herb walks as well, which are sponsored by the American Herbalist Guild, and that occurs monthly. So the best thing to do if you're interested in getting in touch and having classes virtually or in person is go to naturalnurse.com and click on calendar. And there you will see all of our events that you can join in on, and you can get in touch and have a private consultation as well. Today, we are so happy to have as our guest Dr. Jeffrey Moss, and he is from mossnutrition.com, best place to find him. And Dr. Moss graduated from the University of Michigan Dental School and was a dentist in Michigan up to 1985. And then, having employed clinical nutrition in his practice, he decided to use this vast experience and enter the professional supplement industry. So for 25 years, he has operated Moss Nutrition products and has Moss Nutrition professional line of supplements. And he is also an adjunct faculty at the University of Bridgeport Nutrition Institute, and teaches vitamins and minerals classes and also assessment in nutrition class. So he has co-authored a textbook called The Textbook of Nutritional Medicine with Mel Werbach, great medical doctor in holistic medicine and in research. So we're so happy to have him as our guest today. So welcome, Dr. Moss.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate the introduction.
And I know that you are really someone who promotes nutrition and education in a big way.
Very much. I see what's going on in the field of nutrition, particularly in the area of supplements that I specialize in, and I see there's a lot of usage going on, and I think there's a real underappreciation and a lack of understanding of how exactly to use the supplements and the nutrients to get the best effect and get the best value for the dollar spent. So I'm kind of really trying to promote the idea we need to get educated.
Yes, and there is so many studies coming out now. I know you've been doing this a very, very long time, and really the amount of evidence-based information that is available has really expanded.
It really has, and that's kind of a double-edged sword. Certainly there's a lot of information out there. The question is how much of it is good information, useful information. That's to be debated. And so even though there's a lot of good information on there, a little healthy skepticism when you're reading the studies never hurts.
This is true, and not only that, knowing where to find the right studies rather than just,
absolutely,
you know, some internet mention, but actually reading the studies.
Exactly right. Go read beyond the abstract. Read how the research was performed. Was there any indication of bias? Which, you know, researchers are human, and some are biased. And then reading the discussion section to really get an understanding of the conclusions. Were the conclusions that they made based on good, reliable logic, or just bias?
And I believe you are also presenting as part of InnoVision. They have,
yes,
several conferences coming up. Which one are you going to be presenting at?
This one will be on inflammation symposium, and this will be in Minneapolis. And let me get the date here. We're going to be, I think the symposium goes Friday and Saturday, September 22nd, 23rd of this year. And I'll be
coming up pretty soon.
Second. Yeah.
Well, I think that's where I found you, although I believe that we used your information quite a while ago back at Dr. Serafina Corsello, and I was actually her head nurse for about 23 years, and we had a holistic medical center in Manhattan. Yes. And I know you've been sharing information for many years because you said you stopped being a dentist way back in like 1985 or so. So from then on, you were really focusing on holistic nutrition.
Yes, it's been, well over 30 years now. And, you know, I never look back. There was a time for me to be in dentistry, but I had bigger visions, I guess. Dental health is certainly important, but I felt that I could make contributions in other areas.
And I know that one topic, what we said we'd talk about today, which is pretty interesting, disturbances in insulin metabolism, and maybe people think about that in terms of diabetes, but you're linking it to Alzheimer's.
Yeah, there is a tremendous amount of research in this area that I think is just, and I say just, I mean maybe in the last month or so, I'm starting seeing information really getting out into the popular media. Linking the idea of disturbances in insulin, diet, lifestyle, and the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. And while the research has been around for years, in fact, the research is so compelling, many in the researcher community are calling Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes. You know, we have type 1, type 2. We're calling it type 3 diabetes. And, of course, along with this is suggestion that Alzheimer's disease can be prevented. And this is a fairly radical statement because when you look at the media, for the most part, Alzheimer's disease is considered to be somewhat of a roll of the dice, a crapshoot. And if you're just unlucky, bad genes, whatever, you get Alzheimer's disease. Not much you can do to prevent it. Not much you can do once you've got it to slow progression. And fortunately, research, which is just coming to light from a popular standpoint, is suggesting otherwise.
And that is a big departure. But I would say in natural medicine, we have always had so much more of a focus on prevention. And it's just that people have to take action, not just wait till they get ill and then get a prescription.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You know, the kind of thing I'm talking about when it comes to natural medicine practitioners, I'm kind of preaching to the choir here. You're right about that. But we look at the majority of the population, and certainly the mass media, look at the 6 o'clock news, this kind of thing about the idea of preventing Alzheimer's disease is really a radical concept.
Yeah, it is. And boy, you know, that's a really wonderful, actually really positive message that through your own actions, you actually can decrease your chances of getting something, you know, such a terrible illness. And then, of course, on the way, whatever you're going to talk about that might help you not get Alzheimer's disease, in the meantime, one of the side effects is that you're also not going to get diabetes.
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, when it comes to disturbances in insulin metabolism, you can really add to that list just about every major chronic illness in some way, shape, or form involves disturbances in insulin. So the list is virtually endless when you talk about the maladies are plaguing people in today's society.
Well, that's one thing I think is interesting about a particular diet that is called the DASH diet that I know you are familiar with, is that it is actually recommended by the American Cancer Association, the American Heart Association, and the American Diabetes Association. So all three of them are looking at literature, and you know, those, you think those are different roads, but it seems like they all converge, and that by using special eating techniques, exercise techniques, maintaining a particular weight, keeping your blood sugar low, you decrease inflammation, which influences the development of all of those illnesses.
Exactly right. I'm glad you brought the subject of inflammation. Really, when it comes to disturbances in insulin metabolism and inflammation, there are really two sides of the same coin. You really can't have one without the other. You become inflamed, you'll have disturbances in insulin. If you have disturbances in insulin, you'll tend to become inflamed. So they really go together in most chronically ill individuals.
Well, let's talk about some of these new studies that you found interesting, and I know that you are really keeping up with this topic. What kind of new information has come out in terms of links between insulin metabolism and Alzheimer's?
Well, you have to start out with the main anatomic variations, disturbances that tend to be looked at, that are considered to be at the heart of what Alzheimer's disease is. And there's two things. Number one are the amyloid plaques. This is talked about a lot. And then what are known as neurofibrillary tangles. Those are the two anatomic disturbances that when you do some type of scan, you will see in the Alzheimer's disease patient, and how they say, we see this, you have Alzheimer's disease, and along with the relevant symptomatology, the loss of focus, that type of thing. So what the researchers are now looking at in this world of insulin and Alzheimer's disease is they're looking at, well, how did the plaques and the tangles form in the first place? And really what they're finding is that they are, to a great extent, disturbances in insulin metabolism related to basic lifestyle issues. Now, we think of mainly a disturbance in insulin metabolism. Of course, we think diet, high refined carbohydrate diet, and that certainly is a big issue. But one of the things that has to be understood is that virtually any environmental stressor can create disturbances in insulin metabolism. It's not just diet. Too much exercise, too little exercise, lack of sleep, too much time in front of the computer. A toxin, an infection, can all create disturbances in insulin metabolism. This disturbance in insulin metabolism kind of creates kind of a downstream impact, a fundamental disturbance in brain metabolism. As we, many of you know, that the brain relies heavily on glucose as an energy source. And when this metabolism of glucose is being disturbed due to various environmental lifestyle disturbances, insulin becomes imbalanced. And the net effect is you start forming these anatomic changes. I think the best way to really look at what these anatomical changes is they're analogous to coronary artery plaque, and we all know about that as being a cause of heart attacks. And for years, what did we think? We thought that what was the plaquing in the artery was basically gunk. You ate too much fat, and it was just like the gunk going down your drain, and it just clogged up the pipes. That was the old thinking, and that you just needed something like Drano to clean it out, a metabolic drainer to clean it out. And of course, we've learned that's completely false. What the plaque is really, it's a scab, is really what it's most analogous to. There was an injury to the coronary arteries, and the plaque is really a body's effort to repair it, and so it's much like a scab. I think we have to take a look at the neurofibrillary tangles and the amyloid plaquing as just an effort, it's a response. It's the body's effort to repair. The problem is, like the coronary artery plaque, it was an effort to repair, but too much for too long, excessive amounts creates problems. And this is basically at the heart of much chronic illness, is that the body's trying to fix things, but when these stressors go on for too long and they're too great in magnitude, this very response that is designed to fix something actually creates problems. And that's what the body's trying to do with this insulin disturbance. It's trying to fix something related to an environmental stressor, but it was too much, too long, the response was excessive, and that the response itself will lead us to illness, in this case, Alzheimer's disease.
So that's interesting. It sounds similar to what happens in other situations where there's an over-response, such as an autoimmune disease.
Yes, exactly right. The term that's now that's in vogue is what is called allostatic load. Allostasis is the process where the body's response to any environmental stressor, whether it be diet, toxins, infection, whatever it is. We all know about what homeostasis is. That's the body's basically to maintain certain constants, such as blood pressure, pulse, temperature, in the face of a changing environment. Well, what is the mechanism in the body to maintain homeostasis, to maintain constant blood pressure, pulse, temperature? This total body process is called allostasis. We all know about one aspect of allostasis, that's the adrenals, cortisol. We tend to think of that as the stress response. That's actually only part of the stress response. There's a whole body response, and this is called allostasis. But when it goes on too much, too long, you get problems. And that's basically the kind of what we used to call, we popularized as autoimmune. Basically, the body's responding to something, but the inflammatory response was excessive.
And perhaps let me ask you, of course they talk about genetics and they seem to slough off lots of things and say it's all genetics, so there's nothing you can do about it, like it's genetic that so many children now have various kinds of autistic spectrum illnesses. That seems shocking to me. Have our genes changed that much? But similarly with Alzheimer's, now perhaps genetics, of course, does play a role in terms of, let's say, the parameters for your individual ability to maintain allostasis, which might, of course, be linked to genetics.
Well, you're right. Genetics, there's always genetic weaknesses. We all have genetic weaknesses. We have weak areas, weak genes, weak cells. We're programmed to die. Nobody's designed to live forever. And so there's always the issue of genetic weaknesses, or what they call genetic propensity. But the way we like to use genetics, and I understand why people like to use the kind of, it's genetic, because when you use the idea it's genetic, it's kind of like it relieves us of responsibility. Both practitioners,
yes, exactly,
and the public love it. You know, the public says, oh, it's all genetic, I can eat whatever I want. And the doctors say, oh, it's all genetic, I don't have to take any responsibility for fixing the patient, it's all genetic. So it's a wonderful kind of little cop-out statement that we all love. The reality of genetics is basically it creates certain weak areas, but rarely, not always, will genetics, sometimes it does, but rarely will genetics alone create a clinical illness. And when it does, usually it happens at a very young age. You see these very young children with very severe problems. These are almost always purely or 90% genetic. But when,
like, so you're talking about there someone born with a palate deficiency or,
yes,
let's say, Down syndrome, which is actually a gene that could be measured.
Exactly. Phenylketonuria is a classic example of a purely genetic illness. But when people get sick, 50s, 60s, 70s, as we see in Alzheimer's disease, there is a genetic component to it, a propensity, if you will, but almost always the primary issue that's contributed to the clinical entity, the problem that the patient is seeing, is overwhelmingly environmental. So there's a combination of factors, and genes is, generally speaking, a small part compared to environment, to environmental stressors, poor diet, poor lifestyle, et cetera.
So that, I think, is almost considered a radical concept, although the evidence certainly supports that. But back when I started in natural medicine, which must have been 1964, that was considered a radical concept.
Oh, absolutely. Probably up until the last 10, 20 years, it was considered that genes were just hardwired, roll-of-the-dice types of things. The research, I think, started coming out. Certainly was suggestive information, as you mentioned, probably 40, 50 years ago. But the really solid research started coming out probably the last 20 years. So from a research standpoint, the idea that for adult-onset types of illnesses that genes are probably a small part of the problem, that's fairly well established, even though among many today in the public and in the popular press and the mainstream medicine, it is still radical.
Yeah, in mainstream medicine, which of course is run by physicians, who I think should be given more time to read their literature.
Yeah, I saw an interesting study once a few years ago. I'm kind of a bibliophile. I love reading. I love going to medical libraries and reading journals that nobody reads. An interesting study. They did a survey of all of the issues of the journals in the average medical library. 80% of the issues were never read even once.
Right.
Telling statement.
Well, you're really bringing back old times in my mind, because I actually used to schedule one day a week to go to the medical library just to read journals. But I have to say I don't do that anymore, because most of them are certainly available with online access.
Yes, you're right. Actually, I'm that way also. I guess I'm in the virtual medical library now. I spend a lot of time on the websites of these journals.
It's great. It's really great. And then, of course, there's a range in terms of quality of studies. But someone like yourself at Morse Nutrition, you actually give a lot of educational classes, and you're scanning the literature so other people perhaps who don't have time or the inclination don't have to. You're finding the best information for them.
Yeah, I just kind of have felt a responsibility when I got in the supplement industry that I owe more than just a bottle of pills. I owe also an education so that whatever else I'm providing in terms of my product can be used wisely, can be used ethically, and can be used safely. So I've always felt this education issue is of parallel importance to whatever else I am doing. And one of the most important things is to basically try to provide some direction from the onslaught of questionable information that can be found on the Internet. And I don't fault the public. Some of it is quite compelling and is designed to mislead, and unless you've had taken the time. And so, you know, I guess I'd be the same way. My car mechanic could tell me anything. I don't know anything about it, so I try to find ethical car mechanics. Well, I view my job the same way, is I don't expect everybody to take the time to gain expertise on this, and so I feel it's my responsibility to help them kind of go through the jungle of the Internet without being adversely affected.
Well, stand by, because we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we are talking today with Dr. Jeffrey Moss. And we're talking about disturbances in insulin metabolism and Alzheimer's disease. You can find out more about him, the education he provides, and his products at morsenutrition.com. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called tham, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the Natural Medicine Chest.
And thank you so much for joining us once again. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and along with my co-host, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, we bring you the natural nurse and Dr. Z. And you can find archives of today's show on prn.fm, and we also have links at naturalnurse.com radio, which we'll be sending to our guests, and anybody can definitely listen again if there's something here you find interesting and you'd like to revisit. Today, we have as our guest Dr. Jeffrey Moss, who graduated dental school and practiced dentistry and then got involved with a focus in clinical nutrition and became a professional in that area. He's creates supplements as well as educational courses, both for physicians and for the public. And he has a professional line of supplements that he offers through practitioners. He is also on the adjunct faculty at the University of Bridgeport Nutrition Institute. And thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Moss.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, is the University of Bridgeport Nutrition Institute part of the University of Bridgeport in general?
Yes. Yeah, it's one of the programs there, and it's been there for
because I'm
many
very
years.
Involved with them because perhaps you know my co-host and longtime business partner, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. And he's one of the people who actually initiated the College of Naturopathic Medicine at the University of Bridgeport, and is also an instructor as well as a clinical director there.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah.
I don't get involved too much with the naturopathic program, so I'm glad to hear that.
Right. Well, maybe you should go over there. And, you know, you could always give a guest lecture. They're always asking me to do that, and I do regularly, usually on botanical medicine, but you have such a wide breadth of expertise. And as part of the university, we also offer a trip where we take students and any interested individual to live with shamanic healers, really in a jungle setting in the northern coast of Jamaica. And we've been doing that for 30 years.
Wonderful.
So we do all kinds of interesting things through the University of Bridgeport as well. And it's great that you are associated with them and give classes with them. Can anyone sign up?
That's
for people, you know, who are matriculated through the University of Bridgeport.
I'm sorry, say it again?
For your classes, can the general public sign up to take your class, or is it given to students of the University of Bridgeport?
Given to students of the program. Certainly, if you want to become in the program, it's not limited to people with a medical background, and anybody, once they take the prerequisites, they can engage in the program to get a master's degree. And we do have people whose background range from more traditional, what we think traditional, medicine, chiropractic, naturopathic, but we've had students who worked on Wall Street, for example, and decided they want a change of career. So if this field is really interesting, in terms of gaining expertise in nutrition, want to make it more of a pursuit, a life pursuit, you can sign up for the program. It's taught both online. They have an online program and the on-site program. I teach in the on-site program, and if you sign up for the on-site program, you'll get me as one of your instructors.
So isn't that fantastic? Because I have students who do want to move into a more holistic approach in terms of their actual, how they earn a living. And very often when I say, well, you should consider getting a master's in clinical nutrition, a master's in nutrition, they're very turned off because they think it's going to be more of a conventional approach, you know, where you're looking at canned peas and powdered mashed potatoes as a way to have nutrition and getting a lot of the older information. But if they have you for a professor, they're going to get the real evidence-based information.
Yeah, this is clinical nutrition, and I understand. I feel the same way, learning either about traditional dietetics or more academic nutrition where you're just looking, reading rat studies all day. No, this is a clinical nutrition program where you're learning about various aspects of nutrition and how it applies, you know, very intimately to if you're in business, the customers you deal with, if you're in healthcare, your family, your friends, and yourself. So this is a very personalized, very useful and relevant approach to health and clinical nutrition. Anybody who goes this program will definitely benefit. And again, family, friends, and themselves.
Yeah, it's great. I did not know you were involved in it, so that's another good thing for me. That's why I love doing radio. I learn new things every day. Now, when we're talking about the insulin metabolism and its link to Alzheimer's disease, which you're so eloquently explaining to us, and you did bring up chronic inflammation,
yes.
Is there a way, if people were to take their blood sugar level like diabetics do on a daily level, could that be useful for them to try to maybe down-regulate that response, or is insulin and blood glucose levels totally different and not related?
No, there's many good indicators you can do to see if there are disturbances, and one of them is to check your own blood sugar on an hourly basis for about a day and look for any fluctuations. Now, typically, the way we've traditionally done it is we just check it first thing in the morning, fasting blood glucose, and that is valuable. But it doesn't tell us another important aspect of glucose insulin metabolism is what happens during the various things that we do every day. Again, I talked about this issue of response. One thing to get up in the morning and you're rested, relax, you go to the lab, and you have your blood drawn. And that's interesting information. But generally speaking, one of the reasons we get sick is because of an inappropriate or lack of an optimal response to the daily stressors, whatever they may be. It may be your diet. That's what we focus on most often. But it can be simple things. When you get caught in traffic, what is your response? Your thoughts can cause insulin resistance and inflammation. You got caught behind a dump truck in traffic and you're breathing toxins. That can cause insulin resistance, changes in glucose metabolism. So the idea that you're checking blood sugar throughout the day, and you can just get a glucometer at any drugstore, CVS or whatever, Walmart, and check your glucose on an hourly basis, you'll get some idea of how your body is coping with the various stressors, such as diet, but not including diet. That'll give you a better idea of whether disturbances in insulin are really an issue. And again, as we age, these disturbances can affect many organ systems, including the brain.
And, yeah, they're seeing that really we're in a lot more control of our health and ourself than was previously thought. Because let's say we know a particular thing is going to be a trigger. Well, we can use certain herbs that might regulate blood sugar when we know we're having that kind of environmental influence. So we can take a lot more control of what's going on about us. Now, I know you talk in your online classes. We can talk about those because besides going, let's say, for a degree, you have a site that really educates people with all kinds of webinars and lots of information.
Yeah, on my website, yeah, we have a lot of things, videos I've made over the years on various aspects of health, and yeah, many of them are posted on our website, and we're in the process of upgrading our website to create much greater access to the information up there, and we hope to have this a new website up probably in a couple of months or so.
And well, so, pretty yeah, much really everyone I know is constantly upgrading their website.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those things that it's very difficult to stay ahead of the curve because they're always adding new things that are available, and then you have to redo the whole platform, and it's just this ongoing process.
Indeed.
Just
but,
like what you were talking
get
about, you've been doing this so long that you actually would go to the library and read journals, and now you have online access to those journals. And if you wanted to just know about the latest thing in Alzheimer's, you can actually filter so you get a heads up every time new information comes out.
Exactly right. There's plenty of good information out there. Again, the challenge is trying to weed it out, what is good, legitimate information. The more you read, the more you just kind of, you'll be able to kind of gain a sense of what is really legitimate, what is useful, and what may be more manipulative in terms of trying to sell a book or a supplement or a product.
Well, that's true, because certainly there are companies that will pay researchers to use their product in a study. And then, of course, it often comes out positive, right? But when it doesn't come out positive, they could just not publish the study.
Yeah,
so there's
certainly,
usually support.
You see this issue of bias. You're right, where if the results aren't what they wanted, they just won't publish the study. That does happen. Or you'll see where the data is, through statistical analysis, is reframed to fit a certain bias. And give you an example of one of the more obvious ways this is done. If you have a bias, you want to prove that a certain supplement has no value. A nutritional supplement is value. It has no value. We'll see this. Give an example of vitamin D. You see this. Vitamins, of course, are not drugs. They basically do one thing very well, and only one thing. They replete a deficiency. That's what a vitamin supplement tends to do, is replete a deficiency. And so, if you're not deficient in vitamin D, a vitamin D supplement doesn't really do all that much. So it would make sense, if that's the case, that you would create a study. If you want to see the value of vitamin D supplements, you'd want to make sure that all your study subjects are, you want to check what their baseline vitamin D levels are first, because if you're doing, if you don't know what their baseline vitamin D levels are, and if they don't have, they aren't deficient, the supplement's not going to do anything. Well, many, if not most, vitamin D supplement studies don't do that simple thing. And so they'll get, oh, the vitamin D, we checked it against a certain illness parameter and it didn't work. Well, they didn't go back to see if the people they were studying were deficient in the first place. That's one way that bias comes into play.
That's really interesting, because I picked up on the fact that a local hospital group here was Winthrop University. It's a pretty large university in the New York area. I'm sure you've heard of it. They were doing a vitamin D study. So I said, oh, you know what? I fit the parameter age-wise and whatever you had to have or not have in terms of diseases, which, thank God, you know, been very healthy. And so I went to apply for the study, and they did preliminary blood work. And then they said that I was not allowed to be in the study because my vitamin D levels were sufficient. And exactly what you're saying, they were only looking to include people who had low vitamin D to begin with.
That's an ethical group.
Right.
Glad to hear about it.
Yeah, and then, of course, I got all that blood work done, which was interesting as well. So you can apply at various hospitals around the country if you're interested in being in various studies. Now, also, you have on your website a lot of your up-and-coming events if people are interested. Like you mentioned, the InnoVision seminar, and that's in Minneapolis. They're having another one in Florida in November, where I am presenting. That's November 10th and 11th. So there's so many ways for people to learn. And I really am happy that you are pointing out the inflammation connection to Alzheimer's, which is been ignored. We're going to take one more little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Jeffrey Moss, and we will talk more about Alzheimer's disease and what you can do to actually decrease your chances of coming down with the condition, which, of course, is nothing that anybody would particularly want, but there's more control than you think. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Progressive Radio Network, the station for critical issues from critical minds.
The story behind the story, your story, my story. It's all in the mix on Lead Stories right here on BRN.FM. This is Utrice Lead inviting you to share your thoughts and opinions and expand your knowledge about critical issues of the day, Monday through Friday, right after Gary Null's show. Listen live to a broadcast or get Lead Stories whenever you want from BRN's archive. You can even rate the show on iTunes. Now pass the word. Tell the story to everyone you know. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, number one for progressive minds.
thank you so much for joining us once again. We're right here with our guest today, Dr. Jeff Moss, and he is talking about his years of really keeping the research real, reading the studies, understanding what works, what doesn't, and through his information and years of focus in nutrition, he has developed a line of professional supplements. And if you'd like, you know, we don't do commercial sales on this show, as you know, Dr. Moss, but I'm interested in some of the things that you focus on when you're creating a formula.
My number one focus is its clinical utility. In other words, will it really accomplish a certain objective that's important to, at minimum, the people who I deal with, and basically that's where I get my ideas, is from our customers as well as the population at large, or what are the core issues that are really troubling people? Secondarily, what's out there that is there a need? Is what's out there now really beneficial? Can I add something to basically create enhanced value that wasn't there before? Those are the things that I look at the most. From there, once I've decided where is the need, then I will basically go to the research, try to look at the things that nobody else is reading, and just what was missed. Obviously, what is out there now is it's not doing what optimally it should. What can I contribute? And I said something's missing, and I need to find what's missing, so I go to the research and try to create unique formulations.
But also, and I'm sure through your research, you might choose a particular form of a supplement. So I'm interested in your take on that.
Right.
Like, for instance, let's say with CoQ10, there's always a discussion between ubiquinol and ubiquinone. What is your take on that?
Right. Ubiquinone is basically commercial coenzyme Q10. Now, one of the problems with coenzyme Q10 in any form is it's a fat-soluble substance with a very low absorption profile. It's very difficult to absorb under any circumstances. It's typically of what you take in about 3 to 4%, and that may be even pushing the ideal, and that's the commercial form. Now, the challenge is how can we make it more absorbable? You have a commercial form in a powdered form in a capsule, just a capsule with a powder absorption. Even though it's usually a lower cost form, the absorption is going to be minimal. What some companies will do to enhance the absorption is they'll take the powdered form and they'll put it in some type of oil, a fat-soluble type of vehicle, rice oil, something like that, and they'll put it in what they call a soft gel, a pearl, if you will, and that enhances absorbability. But above and beyond that, there's another form of coenzyme Q10 called ubiquinol, and that not only tends to have a better absorption profile compared to commercial coenzyme Q10, it also, once it's absorbed, it tends to basically go where you need it to go in a more efficient fashion. You know, one of the things that we don't often think about with supplements is we often think, well, is it a good form and is it absorbed? And we think, well, once we get it absorbed, we're done. We can just, well, it'll just do what it needs to do. Not necessarily. The question is, has to be asked, whatever supplement you're taking, is it going to go where you need it to go once it's absorbed and do what you need it to do? And this is even more crucial if you're ailing in some way. Healthy people, it's not the body kind of figures it out, but if, like many of us, we have some chronic issues, the body doesn't do as good a job. So we need supplements that make it a little easier for the body to do this. And ubiquinol is one of those substances. It's a form of coenzyme Q10 that is much more easy to utilize once it's absorbed. Ideally, for cost or no object, I tell everybody to buy ubiquinol, and I think the literature and probably the supplement industry would agree with that. The downside is ubiquinol is significantly more expensive than commercial coenzyme Q10, so we have to balance this issue of optimal efficacy in chemistry with cost considerations. So with that in mind, there's room for both forms.
Right, and like you said, the body can, when everything's working right, convert the ubiquinone to ubiquinol. There's an actual process in the enzyme chain. But is it working in that individual? And very often, if they're having deficiency challenges, which means maybe they're not getting it from their food, or maybe they're taking a statin drug, which stops the body's ability to actually even create endogenous CoQ10, that the ubiquinol form might be worth the additional cost.
Exactly right. And above and beyond that, one of the big picture issues, we talked about insulin resistance and inflammation. Basically, what they do in the body is they're general metabolic inhibitors. They prevent conversions. You talked about the conversion of ubiquinone to ubiquinol. This requires enzyme activity. The thing about inflammation and insulin resistance, they inhibit enzymes. You can't make conversions. And so the big picture is we want to take a look at all aspects of our lifestyle, not just diet. We want to take a look at all of the stressors, even the sacred cows. One of the things I try to tell people who I'm dealing with who are quite ill is you have to basically check all your agendas at the door. You can no longer say, it must be that or it can't be that. It must be my diet. It can't be my thoughts. It can't be toxins, or it must be toxins. It can't be that. Check it all at the door. You have to basically look at your life, everything you do and everything you think, from the moment you get up to the moment you go to bed, and seriously and as objectively as possible evaluate, is this particular thing contributing to my problem? That's the way the body works. Anything can cause inflammation, insulin resistance, not just poor diet. As I said, toxins, your thoughts, your computer, lack of exercise, too much exercise, genetics. Look at it all. You have a much better chance of getting the result that you're looking for.
How do you feel about people having, as standard of practice in medicine, regularly testing all their nutrient levels? Do you think that's useful at all?
I would say for everybody, probably not, given the cost. Again, I'm very aware and very concerned about the over-utilization and overspending on diagnostics. It's, I think, a big problem, not just in traditional allopathic medicine, but also I'm seeing it's also becoming a big concern and alternative medicine, as you rely more on somewhat expensive tests. So would I say everybody? No, I would not. As I said, from the evidence I've seen, people do get sick for reasons that have nothing to do with diet, number one. And number two is that when we look at these lab tests, and most of them are done through blood, is that we tend to want to assume that if it's low in the blood, it's always a dietary issue. No. That's not true. It can be low in the blood or high in the blood for reasons that have nothing to do with your diet. For example, vitamin B6 in the blood can be significantly lowered by inflammation, which may have been caused by a toxin, too much worry. So to assume that everything in the blood, what you see, is directly an issue of diet when you're measuring nutrients is inaccurate, and it can lead to false conclusions. It can lead to oversupplementation. So in the general population, no, I would not recommend it, although in specific individuals with specific health concerns, it may be useful.
So I'm really interested that you did bring up B6, because sometimes that's considered controversial in terms of higher doses causing neurological damage. Do you feel, since it's water soluble, that it's okay to take higher levels of B6?
In a general population basis, no. You're right. Higher doses can cause neurologic problems, but beyond that, is it necessary? Is it needed? And is there the idea that because it's natural, there's no potential downside? That's inaccurate. The fact it's water soluble. Water is water soluble, but too much water is one of the most lethal substances known to man. More people have died from water intoxication, commonly known as drowning, than have ever died from a supplement. So we have to be concerned about overutilization no matter what it is, whether we water soluble or anything else. Common sense has to come into play.
That's an excellent answer. And that's why working with someone like yourself in terms of making decisions in terms of what supplements you're going to use, I think is, you know, such an excellent thing to do, because you're not just getting, oh, yeah, you know, take more. It's always better. And sometimes you hear that from commercial purveyors of vitamins.
Yes, indeed.
So each and every one has to be in balance, and then there's always room for what is going on with that individual.
Exactly right. I mean, we have two relevant concerns here. What we do with the individual, that's where I, as a practitioner, have tend to focus over the years, both dealing with clients, the patients, and, of course, as a manufacturer. But we also have to make recommendations for the population at large and finding that balance. And when it comes to the population at large, I tend to be much more conservative than many in terms of saying everybody should do this. Caution to the wind, cost to the wind, everybody should do that. I tend to be more on the conservative side.
And making it sort of individually appropriate. And I really enjoyed your discussion about the fact that each individual, you know, they may have plenty of vitamins, and it might be about the fact that they get overly stressed out about whatever influences are coming at them all day long. So all that has to be taken into consideration.
Exactly right. I know we all have our lives, and I realize there's certain things that we can't change, and I appreciate that. We all have that. Certain family circumstances, job circumstances, we can't change. But even if we can't change it, we need to basically be conscious of the fact that it might be a problem. Be aware of the problem. Don't ignore it. Even though you can't change it, do your best to understand the realities of how you got to where you are in terms of your health. That's the first step to really getting better.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all that wisdom with us today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And I want to remind our listeners that you were listening today to Dr. Jeffrey Moss, and you can find out more at mossnutrition.com. So thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can always get in touch with us at naturalnurse.com. Check out the calendar for the classes and workshops in your area and around the country and online. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.